the thing that I learned is when you have, you know, crazy ideas like this, is not to be afraid to take a chance.
If you're going to eventually be selling or trading something, can you swing your wagon around to get in the position to be selling or trading what everybody wants?
Ladies and gentlemen, farmers, ranchers, and distinguished guests, thank you for listening to the Farm for Profit podcast, where we discuss the latest ideas, methods, trends, and techniques available to help your farm achieve higher levels of farm profitability. The Farm for Profit podcast is co-hosted by Tanner Winterhoff, the Iowa Bankerman, and David Whitaker, the Iowa Land Guy, where in tandem, they will share their ideas and advice from industry experts. Thank you again for listening to the Farm for Profit podcast. Remember, if you aren't farming for profit, you won't be farming for long. And now, here's Tanner and David.
And welcome back to the Farm for Profit podcast. This is Tanner Winterhoff.
And this is David Whitaker.
Thank you, listeners. You are by far the best group of listeners than any podcast has ever had. We appreciate you liking, rating, reviewing, and sharing. And we don't just say this every show. Ultimately, the guests that we get for your ears, the ability that we have to continue to bring you content is all due to your growing of our network. We really appreciate that, right, Dave?
That's right. That's right. Remember to like, rate, and share if you guys like what we're doing. Tell your friends. We'd love them to come listen too. Tanner, we've had so many episodes now. What has it been, a year and a half, something like that? What is your favorite episode of 2020 as we're wrapping up the year here?
I don't know if I can pick a favorite episode. So, listener, if this is the first time you're joining us, we do alternate formats every week. So we have a Farm for Fun format and a Farm for Profit format. So if you catch one of those, continue on listening and tune in. But I'd say I'll start off. One of my highlights of 2020, Dave, was our Farm for Fun show with Brady Smith. Probably not something that you were expecting, but ultimately Brady is a very cool guy, had a very interesting story, and he also introduced me to the Tyrant of Darkness, one of the favorite beers that I have enjoyed. What's one of yours, Dave?
Well, if we're sticking on the Farm for Fun side of the world, Growing Corn 2020 was pretty fun.
Yeah.
One of our TikTok favorites, Tony Reed, he was quite the time. If I had to go with one for our serious side or the business on the front end of our Mullet podcast here, I'm going to say the one that we talked with the gentleman over the pond that was on negotiations, and I don't remember
Miles
the name.
Miles Schraner.
Yeah, that was, if you guys haven't listened to that negotiation one, it's just cool guy, cool thoughts in that one.
That was episode 31. And another one that actually hasn't been downloaded as frequently, one of my favorites was our podcast with the athletics director for Iowa State, Jamie Pollard. That's episode 25. And, of course, Cyclones are doing extremely well currently. And he just shared a wealth of knowledge, a very good interview. So there's a couple episodes, if you're just joining us, to go back and listen to. Dave, but we want to talk about Flying Ag. Flying Ag's one of those companies that sees the mission in Farm for Profit and helping you achieve higher levels of profitability and wants to just share that mission with you. So Flying Ag, they put together kits on the drone side, Dave, and help farmers get into drones or maybe make an upgrade if that's something that you're looking at doing.
And they have from beginner model to the like DJI Mini at $500 all the way up to like $4,000 with thermal cameras. And I think, isn't it, they get a discount, Tanner, with us at Farm for Profit? I know most of them do.
Yep, that's correct. You get an extra battery. Farm for Profit is the code that you're going to use. Now, that code's only good through February 1st, 2020.
So you got to get on it.
Yep, if you pick this up after February 1st, I'm sorry, you're going to want to get in there. So flyingag.com. is who you're going to want to go and use the Farm for Profit code with.
And so, remember, that's the number 4. So farm spelled out 4, the number, and then profit. And you will get a free battery with your order. So thanks to our sponsor there, Flying Ag Drones.
Yeah. Why don't we move into our What's Working in Ag segment?
Well, we have Zach Smith. And Tanner, you find different people everywhere.
Yeah.
Is this a Twitter find?
So Jessamine Smith, who did our succession planning presentation,
okay,
is a relative of our guest today. But we did connect via Twitter.
So the stock cropper. Is that right, Zach? Are you with us?
I am here.
Awesome. So, Zach, tell me a little bit about yourself and connection to ag.
Yeah, so I'm a fifth-generation farmer located in Winnebago County, Iowa, so on the Iowa-Minnesota border. I've spent most of my career here in In you know, basically the retail side of ag business. I worked for an independent chemical retailer for 11 years, and now I'm a Pioneer have a Pioneer seed agency and a granular services agency and sell crop protection, and then I also farm on the side of where my family's operation near Buffalo Center, Iowa.
Nice. So what drew my attention? Well, first, obviously, Jessamyn, you know, told me about you, but I had actually been following you prior to that connection. And what really drew my attention is I was trying to wonder what the heck you were doing. To me, it looked like it was an old chicken shed that you put on wheels and moved through the field. So can you explain to our audience, what is the stock cropper?
Yeah, so the stock cropper is kind of an alternative take to the way that we have agriculture set up currently in Iowa, where we have things kind of separated off and highly specialized. The stock cropper is kind of bringing the components of row crops, livestock back together in the field, happening you know, dynamically and cross leveraging off of each other at the same time. And so what this looks like for folks that are, if you're trying to visualize this, what we did was we basically took the principles of strip intercropping, where most people would be familiar with, you know, folks that maybe grow 8 rows of corn and then 8 rows of soybeans and 8 rows of corn. There's some advantages to growing, especially corn, in that type of a system to drive high production levels. And we were playing around with that that system for the last 10 years, trying to find some ways to bring more value to it. And through one of our friends and some brainstorming, one of my partners in developing this, a guy by the name of Sheldon Stevemer, and then the other friend, his name's Lance Peterson, we were trying to find a different angle of attack on the strip intercropping piece. And Lance suggested, well, what about putting a mobile barn in between the strips of corn? And first we thought it was kind of crazy, because it does sound crazy, but the more we thought about it, it was like, well, what a great thing to, you know, there's a lot of criticisms about our current systems and the fact we don't have enough diversity. You know, Iowa's full of, you know, basically a monocrop system, and this would be an attempt to put crops and livestock back together in the field, and multiple species of both plants and animals. And so that's kind of the setup. So we have strips of corn interlaced with strips of an annual pasture. And we built, we designed and built what we believe is the world's first semi-autonomous mobile barn that houses 4 different species of animals. And we call it affectionately the Cluster Cluck 5000.
The Cluster Cluck 5000, okay.
That was our working prototype name. And basically what it does is that we moved the barn 11, or this year we moved the barn 11 feet. So we had the sheep and the goats out front in the leading pen. They came in a fresh pasture. We had, and then on the back side of the barn, there were pigs that would, you know, graze, and then we fed them a ration in the barn as well, a mobile barn. And then we had chicken tractor that trailed behind that. So in a nutshell, that's kind of what it looked like. And then we had corn growing in between these strips of pasture that we managed to a high degree as well.
So am I hearing you right? You have a barn that moves down the rows, and you're putting different animals in a barn. Am I hearing that right?
Yes. So 4 different species of animals that are, you know, laying their manure down. So we've got 4 different types of manure and gut biology and all sorts of good stuff happening to the soil in those strips.
Okay. So obviously this is catching the attention of our listeners, because it's kind of out of left field as to why we would be doing this. So could you answer that question that they're probably all wondering? What are the benefits of doing it this way?
You know, for me and my partners, you know, we've been very interested in the soil health piece of things. So we're all strip tillers. I've been using cover crops on my farm for a long time. And the thing, if for anyone that studies that realm or puts value on it, the one piece that a lot of folks are missing is livestock and integrating them back into really driving, you know, regenerating soils specifically. And so, you know, the whole reason why is that the reality was, when we were brainstorming this last winter, we were looking at $3 corn and $8 beans. And my partner Sheldon and I are both, you know, smaller producers, and we're like, you know, the way the world's going right now, we you know, with ethanol plants, you know, that have been idled, you know, I don't know if our path in the monocrop world is going to last very long if things keep up like this. So we were looking at a way to how could we come up with a system that would be good for the soil and maybe give us a unique marketing angle with the products that we would produce in this fashion to capture something other than, or to produce something other than a commodity that could be marketed so that we didn't necessarily have to scale to try to be the next 15,000 acre farmer to stay in business. So it was really about how can we stay at our level and be profitable and really address some of the criticisms I think that some folks have, you know, about how our systems are set up currently in the state of Iowa for producing food.
So Zach, that's kind of what our What's Working in Ag section is about, is what makes you more profitable. What did you learn in the first season from doing this? Have you been, is there things, if somebody's going to do it, that they should be doing?
You know, the thing that I learned is when you have, you know, crazy ideas like this, is not to be afraid to take a chance. And that's something that, you know, I know you guys, I think I've had Jason Mock on, and I've become friends with Jason over the last year. He's been an awesome supporter of this project, and that's a mantra and a drum that he beats really hard is, you know, don't be afraid to take a chance and put it out there and see what comes back. Because a year ago at this time, this idea didn't even exist, and we were really actually hesitant to even to put it on Twitter or on YouTube last spring. But I'm really glad that we did. So that'd be lesson number one. Lesson number two, the system worked much, much better than what we had anticipated. You know, we had to try to draw this up on a marker board and build it on Memorial Day weekend and launch it into June. Things went relatively well. We did learn a lot about the pasture management. That was one of the things that we struggled the most with, you know, you got to think about, you know, your animals are going to be at different sizes as you move them through these pasture strips. And we're going to alter our pasture management to try to have species that are really ready at the specific time that the barn is going to be going through. You know, we really didn't know how fast we were going to need to advance it last year. There's a lot of observation and reaction with how we did it. But, you know, that worked well. And, you know, one of the biggest challenges we had with the system with that many different types of animals was the rooting of the pigs in our strips. So as the pigs got bigger, they did more rooting and disturbance. And so if we want to have a level field finish, you know, we're going to have to figure out some strategies, maybe ringing the pigs, you know, for next year to make the system work a little bit better. So those were, you know, just a couple of the key takeaways. Our barn worked incredibly well. We're going to change some design things on that for next year to make it a little bit lighter and maybe try some different animal configurations. We've had a lot of interest from people that would like to see us try to incorporate cattle somehow. And that's going to be, you know, something we try to do for 2021.
Well, you kind of led into my last question here of our segment. So what are your goals for the Cluster Cluck 5000 or the future of the stock cropper?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I think our initial goal was we wanted to come up with a system that would potentially be profitable for us to actually scale up and produce animals in this way and market direct to consumers so that we'd have a more viable farm model. And then, you know, and to build on that, maybe eventually we could scale that out with other people where this could become a production system, a brand, where we could, you know, bring other folks into the fold, other producers that want to be stock croppers, and kind of have a standards of a practice with how we're going to produce these animals, and so that we could have a consistent and effective message to consumers who want to really, you know, have more and you know, be more in touch with where their food comes from. And, you know, consumers are, you know, becoming more, I guess, woke, if you would say, to wanting to know the practices. And one of the things that we did this year to really drive that was we live streamed from Facebook Live our barn every night. So if you wanted to buy our pig, you could literally go on Facebook every night and watch what the pigs were doing and see exactly how they were being raised and see them moving through the, you know, watch us move the barn and all those things. So I think, you know, from a big picture standpoint, that's kind of like, you know, the direction we'd like to head if we could build this thing out, branch out, learn, you know, partner with other people, and develop the market so that we could have lots of stock croppers, you know, potentially producing things in this kind of regenerative fashion.
So, Zach, thank you. That was a very unique What's Working in Ag segment for us. And I know our listeners probably are going to have some questions. So if somebody wants to reach out to you or learn more about what you're doing, what's the best way for them to learn about your operation and maybe get a hold of you?
Yep. So the easiest way to get a hold of me is to send me an email at thestockcropper, and stock is spelled like livestock, STOCK, cropper, CROPPER. So thestockcropper at Gmail. Or you can go to our website, The Stock Cropper. I think I've got my phone number listed on that. You know, you can go and look at our YouTube videos, search The Stock Cropper on YouTube, or follow me on Twitter. I try to communicate a lot of stuff there, at Zebulus Prime, just as it sounds. And then we've also got a Facebook page, Instagram. If you just search The Stock Cropper on those mediums, we should have all those holes filled as far as social spaces. So those would be some of the easiest ways to get a hold of me.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining us on the podcast. We really appreciate the time that you spent with us today and hope you have a good one.
Yeah. Thanks for the opportunity, guys. Really appreciate it.
Another interesting What's Working in Ag segment. We really appreciate the Stock Cropper for swinging by to share a little bit about his story and what he's got working on. So now, as we approach the end of 2020, our main focus for today is kind of giving you a summary of the year. We really want to take a look and give a market update on both the land value side and the machinery value side. So, Dave, who do we have as a guest today?
I tell you, we have a great guest that a lot of our farmers probably already know. Goes by Machinery Pete. Greg Peterson is on with us today, has over 25 years of experience in the machinery business. His website, machinerypete.com, is the premier online destination for farmers and dealers, providing comprehensive used farm values of farm equipment. A searchable database with tens of thousands of farm equipment listings. I know there's over 500,000 auction sale prices there, roughly 70 different categories of equipment, making it, Tanner, probably the most comprehensive and complete database of its kind for farm machinery. He authors regularly columns for the Farm Journal, Implement and Tractor, and Top Producer Magazine, blogs on Ag Web, and I think you're connected with RFD TV, correct?
Yes, we have our Machinery Pete show. It's in season 8 out there, so we good friends at RFD there. Good folks.
Awesome. Welcome to the podcast, Greg. But listeners, I can't let David slide by because he's going to be relied on for the expertise today. So probably been a while since we've properly introduced you, Dave. Dave, world champion auctioneer, grew up immersed and involved in agriculture, started his career off with the Missouri Auction School. He has won many buckles for his auctioneering ability. He's licensed realtor. He is active in the Realtor Lands Institute, the National Auctioneer Association, and a number of state auctioneer associations as well. David and his wife, Ann, run Whitaker Marketing Group, and in June 2020, took the role of the area sales manager for Farmers National Company, licensed salesperson in Iowa and Nebraska, and currently chairman of the board of the Iowa Auctioneers Association. So, Dave, your expertise does not go unnoticed either.
Well, thank you. Thank you. We're going to talk a lot about end of the year discussions today. And definitely with Greg on here, we got an expert. Let me start by saying, you know, farmland has had its ups and downs. It's a COVID year. It's kind of crazy. But right now, I've seen a ton of auctions happen. Probably the same amount of farmland has sold 1% more than last year, Tanner, in number of acres. And currently, with commodity prices on the rise towards the end of 2020 here, we've seen land prices take a rally, and they've come up at least $1,000 an acre.
Wow.
Greg, what are you seeing in equipment? Are you, auctions-wise, year-to-year, last year, more or less?
I would say slightly more auctions, guys. What we've seen with the pandemic, the unbelievable shift, unprecedented, into the online auction space has sort of created more players. Individuals can throw up their own shingle and they, you know, get your 10, 15 items you might be selling for a farmer or his retirement sale, whatever. And there's just been more auctions. And pricing-wise, the market, frankly, is just on fire here as we come to the close in 2020. Was a strong year sort of to begin with, but when commodity prices went up this fall, I mean, it is kind of Katie bar the door for good condition used farm equipment right now. Pricing is just smoking hot.
So you're attributing most of that to the rise in commodity prices. Do you feel like coronavirus had anything to do with affecting it one way or the other this year?
Well, I actually do. I mean, I would say, you know, if we reel it back to the spring when, you know, COVID descended upon us, you know, to me, the used market had been solid to slightly up for about 2 years at that point. So the market, used market was pretty solid, definitely stronger than it had been from 14, 15, 16, 17. And it was a lot of concern when the pandemic hit. I mean, frankly, it was the busiest time of year for auctions. So there was a lot of unknown there. Would we have mass cancellations? Is the pipeline going to get jammed up with people looking to sell? Dealers, I mean, are they going to get stuck? Is everyone just going to kind of hit the pause button here? But actually, I think the shift to online has just been just incredible. And in a way, I think everyone, we've had 15, 17 years now or whatever of online bidding. But when it became strictly online, I think in a weird way, people were conditioned to click one more time. And it's hard to explain, but all I know is compiling all the pricing right through since March, the valuations have gone up on good used equipment. And then when we layered in the commodity prices going up this fall, what that pulled in is it activated the tax law changes that President Trump made a couple years ago, beefing up the Section 179, which, I mean, if you went back to the stuff I wrote in late 07, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, I mean, that's why I always tell people if I were retiring, I would retire in November, December and have my auction. And this year, particularly because people have, you know, they're just more optimistic, have a little money, and the dollar bills are flowing, but it's got to be good condition. So that's kind of what I'm seeing.
That's a good point. And Dave, he kind of hit on something that equipment has had online bidders for quite some time, but traditionally land sales have been in person. Let's go to the community center, sit down, you know, larger ones, let's meet at the farm, those type of situations. Did this force land sales to go more online now too?
Wholeheartedly, you know, it's crazy across the market. We as auctioneers wonder, is everything going to go online? Is it ever going to come back to live? Most of ours, based on the state and your proclamation from your governor, can you have them live? Some guys have moved to doing it out of their pickups on the farm. Some guys have done live virtual. I've seen a lot of that where it's still got the live outcry, but everybody bidding is online. And then there's the strictly online only eBay style, but with one caveat, and that's called a soft close, where at a normal auction, we wouldn't just say, you're the last bidder sold. We would say, you're the last bidder. Let's ask one more time. Anybody else? Are we done?
Going once,
then
going twice.
The unchallenged bidder becomes the buyer. But we have to give that challenge period. That's called a soft close. So yes, land has moved online. And a good friend of mine, Scott Steffes, once told me, Dave, however you offer it, once you train your customers, they will come and buy. Well, as Greg just said, we've been maybe training our customers for the past 17, 18 years, so it was less of a transition anymore. Some of the older farmers still are grumpy and complain and whatnot, but moreover, everybody's made the move, and we've sold millions and millions of equipment and millions of farmland online. So I wonder then, will it change? However you offer it, they will show up.
The adapt and change, and this might have forced our hand to make this switch a little bit quicker than we were anticipating. But another thing that you mentioned, Greg, is good used equipment. Is there a certain category right now that is smoking hot? You know, I'm thinking, is it a quad track? Is it a planter? Is it a something? Is there a category right now that sticks out to you?
It might be easier to identify what's not smoking hot, and that list is pretty small. In fact, I'd struggle. I mean, if any equipment right now, if it's in good shape, is selling well. And of course, what's always been the biggest driver behind it is the rising cost of new. And I think in a weird way now, I think when the pandemic was first coming, I think at the manufacturer level, there was a natural pullback because you have to try and make assessments on how much equipment are we going to sell here. So it became kind of natural to pull in the reins a little bit. Well, sort of what that does, it just tightens things. So one of the pieces of the puzzle I'm seeing is that the inventory level on used on dealers' used lots is tighter than it was. I think the issue is we had about 10 years there where, you know, dealers had way too much late model equipment, and we sort of took that'll always be the case. Well, it's changed, and now if you get into certain areas, like the hottest sectors would be a good used tractor or combine with some age on it, you know, just pre-tier 4, pre-def. If you want that, the problem is 10 other guys want it more.
Yeah.
And when you apply an auction method to that item, that's when we're getting this daily breadcrumb trail of, you know, here's a John Deere 9670, 2010 or 11 model, low hours. And it's so, you know, I'll document it and say it's the highest auction price in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. Just last night on an auction in Virginia, which used to be that would be far enough south where you'd kind of be apples and oranges to upper Midwest. But they had a 27 model Deere S670, brought 298,000 with no heads. That's the highest auction price I've ever seen in the U.S. on an S670 coming out of the deep south.
Those got to be low hour combines, though. Is there hour level demographic? Like when you hit 2,000, are guys not buying that used late model type stuff, but under 500, we're still...
Yes, that's, you're on it, David. It's totally true. It's got to be the condition. So the 1 to 3 year old stuff, if it's low hours and has warranty left, that's still hot. Again, even at that 298,000 price point, you know, when I post that on Facebook or Twitter, you know, about 30-40% of the people say, those guys are nuts. What are they smoking? But another 30-40% say, no, you know, actually, have you priced a new one lately? And this thing only had 317 SEP hours on it. So 298, actually, that guy got a heck of a deal.
Yeah.
So again, that rising price of new just pulls everything up.
That's interesting, because I was talking to a gentleman that sells vehicles. And he said, right now, it's hard to find a pickup truck. If you want to go and buy something new, I think it's probably a lot on the factory line. They fought COVID too. They fought people coming into work, you know, not a natural pullback, like you said, probably a lot of factors implemented that have affected the new production of equipment. But Dave, let's frame this question in on the land side. Is there a type of land that's hotter than others, or is just the whole market hot?
Very much so. So good quality ground in Iowa. For those listeners outside of Iowa, we have a productivity index, or a CSR score, and 100's the best looking girl and 0.5 is the worst. And so when I sell in Iowa, if you're 80 or better, so you're an 8 good looking girl at the bar or better, that type of land is selling really good right now, more than the mediocre ground. And then there's even a rise in the lesser ground, and I'm going to explain why here. So the top end ground, with the election and the possible new administration, there's going to be a new administration of some sort, but depending on which side you're leaning that's going to go, Tanner, there's people, I'm going to say, scared in the stock market, and they're pulling their money out of the stock market, and they're just looking for investment. What used to be, I had guys wanting 4% rate of return on their money, now is 2.5. So with 2.5 rate of return on that, we have a lot of those guys coming in. The farmers are still out there, still giving, you know, 275, 300 cash rent per acre, and they're making that 2.5 rate of return. And so we see a new customer coming to my market. And with that market on that upper end ground, the good looking ground, the best square, flat, black tillable soils, we have people competing for that.
So mathematically, that makes sense. I mean, Greg, that makes sense in your side of things too. If you're okay settling for a lower rate of return, that allows you to spend more on that asset, which is going to drive, you know, make that second bidder a higher bid, pushing those values high. But what about that lower quality stuff you were talking about?
And so the lower quality end, the middle, I think, is still where there's money to be made, because you make money when you buy it, not when you sell it. And if you buy it right, then you make money. Money's made in the margins. However, on the low end ground, COVID and the pandemic has pushed people outside of the city. And so a lot of them want that recreational oasis away from the community, place to go play with their kids, fish, hunt, etc. And so I've actually seen a little bit of a rise in that, and people wanting the recreational style ground, not necessarily cattle pasture, but recreational ground.
Timber.
Just for the recreation side of it. And so some people wanting to put their money there.
Okay, so interesting that you brought up that you make money when you buy, not when you sell. Greg, what have you been seeing from the seller side? Who's selling this equipment?
Well, one of the questions we're getting a lot, we're seeing a lot of farm retirement sales with exceptionally low-hourly equipment. And people say, you know, for example, today, our friends at Steffes had a sale. It was an estate-type deal up around Litchfield, central Minnesota. I think the guy had a 2007 John Deere 7830, like 500 hours on it. So we post, and the price is going to be sky high. It'll be like a record type price. Steffes does an awesome job always. But people say, well, why does it have 500 hours on it? Well, you got to go back. You know, a lot of this iron back in 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 was bought kind of not always completely, but for the high extent for tax purposes to minimize your taxes. And I think what farmers are, you know, you won't find a smarter bunch of business people. That's just, you survived, and if you're a 70-year-old farmer, you went through the meat grinder of the 80s, came out the other side, you know what's yanking. So in their bones, I think farmers know that low-hourly equipment, 10, 15, 20 years old, that's what everybody wants because the price of new is so crazy high all the time, that a lot of people bought that new iron back when money was flowing and kind of used it, but definitely with an eye towards keeping the hours off it. So now when it's time to retire, all across the country, like the guy in Virginia last night, he had 8360R with 600 hours. He had 8320R with 700 hours. He had what everybody wants. And what I've always, I'm kind of a big proponent of the theory of opposites, stock market and otherwise. But if you're going to eventually be selling or trading something, can you swing your wagon around to get in the position to be selling or trading what everybody wants? Now, that might take a decade of planning on your part, and you need the capital to make it work. But when you do, this is what I'm reporting on every day, is when you're selling this good iron that everybody wants, the prices are just sky high. And so I think for your listeners who have a keen eye towards profit, I mean, long-term thinking is really the key. And obviously, David, you've seen it on the farmland side, keeping your powder dry. So when that right piece of ground comes up locally, you're ready to pounce on it. But I've just been intrigued by the correlation between the used machinery market and the land and the ag land market. Like David was saying, the 8 out of 10, it's exactly what the used farm equipment market is. If you're good condition, it's hot. Get into that middle, there's some opportunity there. But yeah, it's fun to track this stuff.
Yep. I was just going to say, just like Greg said, there's your takeaway, listeners, right there. If you want to position yourself for the future, so we have a lot of young listeners, but if there's some guys that are looking to retire, or you're the son or a relative of somebody that is going to retire, there's your tip of the day right there. Maybe position your wagon in such, start looking ahead for the future.
And we know firsthand, like you said, Greg, that the farmers are extremely smart business people. I mean, that's why they're listening to this podcast. They're always wanting to better themselves to try and learn a possible way. And it is fascinating to see those guys that knew they were buying an extra piece of equipment. It's still going to get utilized some, but it's certainly limited. You know, when you see the low-houred machinery come up and you wonder how or why, it is. It's a long-term vision and part of an investment. If new equipment continues to rise in values, I could see where, you know, low-houred used equipment is probably not a bad investment, and maybe you get more than what you paid for it if you hold on long enough. What do you think, Dave?
I think you're right. And I was going to ask Greg, do you have an opinion for our farmers? Everybody asks me in farmland world, Tanner, is when's the best time to sell? When's the best time to sell? You know, should we sell in the fall? Should we sell in November? You know, and traditionally, historically rather, November, more land sales than any other month, more land trades hands. And I think that's specifically because that's when people make their new lease agreements for next year after harvest. There's an old adage that full bins sell farms. I'm wondering, do you have an opinion, Greg, on when the best time to sell your equipment is? A lot of guys say planter, oh, we got to sell it in the spring. And combine, we got to sell it in the fall. Do you have a generic?
Great question, David. And that kind of gets right into the wheelhouse of, you know, compiling this stuff every day for 31 years like I have. What I'm finding is the timely, if you have good condition used equipment, timing is less important than it used to be.
Okay.
Because of the online aspect now, And just the fact that everybody wants what they want is that 8 out of 10 you were just describing. But I would still say November, December is when if I were having a retirement auction, that's when I would have it. And the way I always looked at it was, you know, it was interesting going to auctions all these years in August and September, you know, around the country, and crops would be looking good, but until it's in the bin, it doesn't mean jack. And once it's in the bin, then it's like something, we're humans and we think certain ways. And once it's in the bin, then I know what I got and I know what I need equipment wise for the next year. And my thought was, why would you want to be at the end of that line selling in March or April, which tended to be when we'd have all these huge regional consignment sales around St. Patrick's Day. And like you say, oh, that's when I have to sell my planner. Well, no, sell it, you know, end of the year. And I think the tax buying force really changed that about 10, 12 years ago. But so if it's good condition, you're going to be fine anytime. But again, I think the more question marks you can take out of the equation, how am I going to come out this year? Once farmers know, I think then they're ready to act. So
that might be the reverse, Tanner. If you want to buy equipment and some of our listeners are buying, you might try to hit a sale sometime in the middle of July. If there happens to be some markets out there, you're looking on one of those online bidding websites. If you're trying to play the day trading game, if you will, or the sure. I'll call it the annual trading game, you might buy in the summer, use it, and if you're going to sell, you might sell towards the end of the year. I will make the argument for farmland, though. When people ask me that, I sometimes say, whenever you're ready to sell is the best time to sell, Tanner. And why is that? So unlike a combine, unlike a planter that there's maybe a million of them on the market, there's only so much farmland. And that farmland only comes up for sale next to you once in a lifetime.
Pretty much, yeah.
And so I'll tell sellers like, oh, we should wait until there's, you know, until November or something. And I say, look, if you're ready to sell it now, now's the time to sell it, because the neighbors, they're going to find a way to buy it. If the neighbors want to farm it, if they've looked at your farm for the last 75 years and today is the day to buy it, it's not like they can buy another one of those in November when they see the grain bins are full. Yeah. They're going to buy it today. So there's a little variance there.
And that's a good point. There, you can't section 179 a piece of ground. So, no. So I could see why that end of the year makes sense on the equipment side and not necessarily on the land side. Well, I don't want to skip over this part, though, Dave. We asked Greg who the sellers are for land. What are you seeing? Who's selling farmland?
Most of that is estates. So we see two seller types. One is like the 179 deduction. It's a tax deduction for equipment where you can take full depreciation of that in 1 year. There's a Section 1031 tax code. And we actually just did a podcast with David Brown, IP 1031 on that. And so the one seller I see is the seller that sold a farm, maybe fixed it up, put tile in it, made some terraces, etc. They're going to sell it. And then when they sell it, they're going to transfer into ground maybe closer to them, or we bought ground farther away and now we're just trying to move our operation closer to home. So that's one of the sellers, a Section 1031 investor buyer, if you will. The other seller is, I don't see many of them, but you might see this at the banking side. I don't see much pressure to sell because the balance sheet isn't there. Not right now. Contrary to what the news might tell you, I don't have many guys say, you know, the balance sheet just doesn't work. I got to sell this 40. I got to sell this 180. We don't want to wish that upon anybody, maybe more traditionally like the 80s. The estate sellers, where grandma passed away, now kid lives in Virginia, haven't been on the farm for 40 years. What do we do with this land? Well, we could have a farm manager manage it. We could try and just trust the tenant who's farmed it for grandma all these years. Or we could sell it, and right now, land is hot, so when you see dollar signs, you think, man, if I can only get 2.5% on that cash rent lease, man, I might be able to get 6% in the market. Their financial advisor might move them back to the stock market, if that's what they're more familiar with. People do what they're familiar with, so they'll move their money out. So I see the kids of the estate selling. One more thing. They also get stepped-up basis. Under the current administration,
somebody
passes away, then they don't have any capital gain tax to pay on that. So if there's a time to sell, it's right after the date of death.
Well, that's an interesting observation. The farmers have equipment sales for retirement. but they hold on to their land, must use it as kind of an annuity, collect cash rent through retirement, and then the estate sells the land. So something I picked up there. Well, I want to kind of throw a wrench in the direction of our podcast here, Greg. And Dave, I want you to also answer this question. I'm always curious, Greg and Dave, what's your favorite part about what you do? I mean, I don't know if you knew you were going to go this direction, but what's your favorite part about being Machinery Pete?
Well, it's a great question, Tanner. I didn't train for media at all. I was an accountant major. Numbers have always been my thing. So on the one level, I sort of enjoy the geeky part, the nerdy part of analyzing values and trends up and down. That's fun. But as I've been doing it now so long, it's the people that I encounter along the way. So when we're going out, might be to a farm show, I've just been sort of shocked at what is possible to learn and pick up just from asking people questions. So that part of the physical auction I miss the most, when we can't get out and be together, just hanging out and having a hamburger and, hey, Fred, you know, what's shaking in Tennessee? Well,
yeah.
I don't know, and I'm happy to listen. And then as our business has grown and we've been able to build out our media properties, being able to share some of these stories of the people with their machines and the connections, that is probably the most fun part of what I do. And the actual day-to-day reporting, again, because I didn't train in it, what I love is not knowing where the story is going to be. So every day we get up and, you know, there might be a disc bind that sells in Georgia that sold high. The next day it's a combine out of Montana. The next day it might be an antique tractor out of Texas. And I just like rolling with the punches like that. It's just been great fun.
Well, that's cool. I didn't know what to expect for an answer to that. But what about you, Dave? And in your daily business, what's your favorite part about the job?
You know, it's somewhat similar. And so generically, it's the people. But back up 20 years for me, some of our listeners know, some don't. I just retired from being a firefighter. So I, like you, did not go to school for what I necessarily do in the agriculture business. But I talk a lot. I talk fast, got me into auctioneering, and I just wanted to talk fast. I didn't realize it's a $270 billion industry, the auction. And so after just being in it and learning to talk fast and meeting those people, then I was like, this is so cool. I get to go out. Somebody, rather than saying you have ADD, says, hey, I like it when you talk fast. This is good. So I liked the people that accepted me into the industry.
Yeah.
Now moving into the farmland world, like to just learn more about agriculture, having a firefighter and paramedicine background, didn't know as much. Of course, in the Midwest, I think in Iowa, it's like every one out of six jobs is in agriculture. So you're immersed in it, in this area. And now I get to travel from state to state and help my agents. So I get to help my internal customers, but then help the external customers. This is the biggest one-day decision they'll probably ever make in their life. Now, most of our non-farming listeners, they buy a house and it's $250,000. That's a significant, you know, and could they sell it themselves? Sure. You can go on Zillow. You can go on Facebook. You could sell your own house, but they want to use that trusted professional. Well, just take that exponentially times a lot more money. And we sold one last week for $9 million. Okay. At $9 million. Think of the entire thought process for that family to sell that farm and the amount of emotion that's in it. I like helping them realize that emotion, learning the story. That farm had been the entire life, two bachelors. I mean, it was so fun to hear the story.
Yeah.
And then you get to help them through that process as their trusted advisor.
Well, I think it's fun to see that both of you enjoy a lot of the same things in your roles, but yet are doing two very different jobs. So, all right, let's get back to what we were trying to educate our listeners on. We were talking a lot about the sellers. You mentioned a little bit about the best time potentially to buy, but Greg, who has been the buyers of this equipment? Who has been paying up to set these records on buying a piece of equipment?
Well, I get asked that daily. People say, well, you know, who could pay that premium price? And I think it goes back to a little bit something what I think David mentioned earlier, you know, strength of the balance sheet. It's just not the 80s. You know, I think, again, that farmers are extremely smart business people. And I think over the coming out of the period from late 07 to early 13, when, so to speak, the money spigot was a little bit more open in agriculture, I always thought that if you came through the 80s, or your dad did, and that was in your craw, and now when times are good, yeah, you spend money on iron and land, but you're managing long term. So I think balance sheets are strong, and I think that what we've seen on the equipment side is, again, I mentioned earlier, even before the pandemic hit and used values took off a little bit, it had already been on the upswing for about 2 years. And that was just a replacement cycle factor. So a lot of people bought so much new iron from 08 into like maybe early 14 that when that commodity prices fell and dealers were stuck with way too much late model used, farmers en masse just kind of said, you know what? I'm good. I can't trade in. I can't do the three-piece trade-in that I've been doing for years. My dealer can't take it. He's already got too much stuff. So I'll just keep it and maybe keep some hours off it. And, you know, I think that that's okay for 1, 2, 3 years, but you get out to year 4 or 5, and if you're still farming that ground, and we've seen a couple previous falls that we did when your time windows are so short or in the spring, you need reliable equipment to get the job done. And so we started to see farmers hopping in to buy a new planter on the used market or new or a combine, whatever, because they had to be running. And again, that focused it more on the really good condition used equipment. And so I think those folks have been the buyers. And, you know, there's the same amount of ground out there. It's got to be farmed. So to do that, you need good equipment.
I have been noticing that locally with my customers and prospects, that we ran equipment a little longer than we used to, put some more hours on, got some more years on a piece of equipment. But what I found interesting is maybe I'll depict it as tiers. You had the farmer that always bought new and then traded either every season or anyway, created that lightly used category. And then you had the group of farmers that bought lightly used and ran it until it was, you know, still a fairly decent machine. And then you had those who bought the more used and ran it until it might not go back to sale again. And when the top of the funnel stops buying or runs longer, it all starts to get itself backed up a little bit. But what about on your side, Dave? I can kind of predict a little bit of your answer is going to be the investors you've been talking about. But outside of the investors coming in and buying the ground, who else has been buying farm ground?
And so the numbers are probably 80% farmers and 20% investors.
Oh, so
it's actually skewed the other way. There's new investors coming in. So that's traditionally what it has been. Now, will it get to be more? I think it will, but it's hard for investors to get in unless you have a checkbook too. It's not just anybody with $100 buys farmland. So there's a different opportunity, but mostly I'm going to argue that most of our farmers are investors. There are guys that literally just buy more ground near them because it's dollar cost averaging. So when you talk about, like Greg said, how do you afford this high equipment? Well, guys will ask me, we just sold a farm for $13,000. Another one I saw sell for $15 an acre. They can't make that pencil out for $3, $4 corn. We got to be up to $7, $8 corn to really make that pencil out. And how it does pencil out is, one is opportunity to buy. The day we're selling is now. It's for 70 more years. It's not going to come for sale. So banks are crucial. And investment money is crucial for farmers. But they dollar cost average it. So let's say an example, farmer A has, they own 400 acres free and clear. Dad bought it in the 80s. I inherited it. I own it. I also rent some of grandma's ground. She gives me a deal though, because I'm a grandson. And so I get it for a cheap rent at $50 an acre. I rent from a couple of locals, at a $200 an acre rate. And now this farm came up for sale. Well, when we buy it for $15,000, there's no way that it will pencil out. However, when we pencil out the amount of equipment going over the more acres now, we take the free ones, I say the free ones, the one we only pay tax on and any improvement, the low cost, the medium cost, the semi-low cost, and average that with the super high cost, averaging it out, it still averages to about a $250 cash rent. Well, that's how they're buying it. If you're the new farmer right out of school, ag business degree and you say, I'm trying to buy this farm, not a chance.
Not going to work.
It's not going to work. If you have some reputation, family, and other assets in it, it's dollar cost averaging. The other thing is there's old money out there. There is money in the outliers that has just been waiting with a lot of paid off farms. So I'm going to give Iowa as an example. 82% of farms are paid for free and clear.
I was going to use that stat. You took that one from me. So I had that banker stat in the back of my pocket. 82%,
man. I mean, that's a lot of money that's paid for. So when I go to you as a banker and say, hey, I want to buy this other farm, you're going to say, you got millions in the bank in equity in the other farms you own. Heck yes, I'm going to loan you.
Right.
That's why they're buying that expensive farm ground.
Right. Okay. So let's kind of skate around to another angle of this, Greg. We've got listeners that don't have that low-houred, high desirable piece of equipment or that low-acred piece of equipment. What have you seen farmers doing that has made their sale successful when they aren't relying on low hours or lightly used? You know, what have they done to something that has had more exposure to it?
Well, I think right now one of the things I'm most excited about looking forward in the whole used equipment space, whether you're a dealer, auctioneer, private seller, is just the new tools at our disposal, particularly social media and these cell phones we all have in our pockets. And frankly, we use cell phone video on our TV show. It's such high def quality. And so if you're thinking of whatever the case might be, if you have the late model, low hour stuff, or if you got, you know, stuff that's more in the middle condition wise, there's this untold opportunity right now to personalize what you're selling. And I've been kind of preaching about this from a soapbox about 4 years now. And some auctioneers are starting to see the light, and dealers need to catch up a little bit. Private sellers are maybe right on par with auctioneers. But if you think about it, whatever you're selling, if it's you're selling a loader tractor privately or you're having an auction, to a large extent, what you're selling is yourself and how you've cared for that piece of equipment. And even if it's just average condition, what I've seen is if you call out the issues it has, like, hey, folks, I'm selling this, whatever, this loader tractor, and it's had this leak for about a year and a half. I can't figure it out. On the one hand, you might think, well, that's stupid. Why would you say that when you're trying to sell it for max dollars? But what I've seen, these new tools, particularly video, if you put that little video out on Instagram or, you know, YouTube, and these things cost $0, by the way. You just put that out there. What it does, it kind of reaches through the screen and grabs you by the collar and says, look at this. I'm telling you about my loader. I'm telling you the issues. And it pulls in bidders in a powerful way. David, I'm sure you know, when you were out selling at auction, you probably had sales where you guys give the mic to the guy who's retiring. And particularly in the upper Midwest, you know, farmers are just honest people that they'll say, hey, tell me something about this combine, Fred. And Fred gets the mic and he'll start saying, well, I tell you, I had this one issue. I just can't. And you think, oh, Fred, be careful. Don't say that. But every time I've seen that, you wind up getting two more bids. So I think representing what you're selling in your own voice is powerful. And the hurdle we have to get over here in the Midwest is that it's not, particularly with older farmers, it's not in our DNA to say how good my machinery is. You think it, but to say it out loud, to say, what I tell people, don't think of it like that. Just pretend like we're at the coffee shop and I say, hey, Tanner, tell me about your tractor. When you do that, it's super powerful and stuff sells for more money when you do it.
You know, if there's going to be a guy out there that has a really hot sale someday, I know it won't be for a long time, but it's going to be Andy Pastor.
Yeah.
Hashtag Andy Clean. That guy is probably going to set records in every single category. But I like what you said there, Greg. That's valuable. That's really valuable information. So, guys, we're not going to quite wrap up yet, but I'm going to ask a question, and you don't have to be right. I want an opinion. Where are we going in 2021? Dave, let's start with you. Land sales. What's your prediction for 2021? Start with Iowa and then kind of go broad, if you would.
Sure. I'm very bullish in this department. We've seen an increase. I think it's going to increase even more. I'm up 5 or 6% in the market, and I think it's going to keep rising on good quality stuff on the 8, 9s, 10s. The medium quality people are going to look for opportunity there. That's when I think of machinery. I think the word machinery jockey, they might buy it, flip it, sell it, house flipper, land jockey, someone that buys it, farms it a couple years, puts it in WRP, CRP, something, moves it down the road. Low end ground, it's going to just, the recreational value will stay steady with that.
Probably proximity would help that category, if anything.
Yep. And then as we move, even west, you go to Montana, go to Oklahoma, all that ground I've seen staying pretty steady, all across Nebraska. We had sales there last week. Illinois, it's been on fire. Anything through the Corn Belt has been on fire. Any of the I states, Iowa, Indiana, Illinois, we've been getting $11,000, $12,000, $13,000, $15,000 an acre on any of those. We had one in Missouri the other day that kind of set a record to where the tillable ground brought $9,000. And for Missouri, that's kind of unheard of. So
right.
I'm actually thinking we're going to trend that way. Now, is there a bubble? Are we in the 80s? Is this going to pop? My answer is no, because the back end reason, we still have low interest rates. We still need food, and the government's not going to let that go down for sure. And we have a lot of old money out there. And in the agriculture world, that old money is going to stay and it's going to go. We're not in that pop point where the balance sheets are ready to blow.
I'm going to toot my horn. It's not my horn. It's not even a bank's horn at all. But regulation on banks, I think, is going to prevent that from happening. There's a lot more scrutiny to loan to value and maximum debt per acre that is probably going to protect a lot of balance sheets from getting overloaded just by law.
In the 80s, there was way more leverage than there is today. What is it, 65% right now about loan to value?
Yeah, and then most banks will put in a cap of debt per acre. You know, if it's $10,000 ground, we still might not get to that 65%, depending upon which financial institution you work at. So, Greg, what about on the equipment side? What's your predictions for 2021?
Well, I'm going to keep our machinery land correlation going, and I'm just going to pair it right exactly off what David said. And I think the exact same thing will happen with the equipment market in 2021 for a couple reasons. I think, again, it's been 2 years that used values had been already kind of slowly trending upwards. And I think one of the big pieces of the puzzle, again, that people need to really think about here is at the dealer level. So farmers don't necessarily like the fact of this rapid consolidation of the dealer network. And it's been a breathtaking consolidation. I mean, it used to be the six and eight store locations buying the onesies, twosies. Now it's the 20 locations buying the six to eights.
Right.
And one of the things coming out of the last, I guess you could say, pileup of, 2013, 14, 15, 16, dealers learned some hard lessons. That was a lot of blood they had to pay. They had way too much late model used. And now you've crunched the number of dealers down in a big way. And these are well-capitalized outfits now that are really, they've taken the gut level approach to the used inventory. I mean, that's quaint. That's in the past. Now it's a data play. And I don't think we're going to run into the bottlenecks of stuff piling up on the used lot on the dealer side, which in theory then, gives them a better chance to sell new equipment. So it's smart business. But again, I think that will keep the premium on good quality used equipment. So I think we're going to see, a strong 2021 for used equipment values, particularly in that, 8 to 10 range David was talking about condition wise.
Do you think I'm going to back up 10 minutes to what we talked about. We were talking about the 8s to 10s, the 5 and 6 equipment in the bottom. You kind of mentioned three different tiers. Greg, I would ask, money's made in the margins, okay? So we can be that farmer. So let's give some advice to our farmers here, Tanner. You could be that farmer that goes to the bank and borrows that $250,000 and buys the brand new combine, and it's got a lot of tech on it. Okay. Individual row shutoffs on our planters, down pressure, 2020 down pressure, center fill makes our job faster, quicker, easier. But it cost us. Okay. And then I got a local farmer down the road here, Dennis. I'll just say Dennis. And Dennis, he has the old, 1586. He's got a couple of 300 bushel grain wagons, and he's, 12 row everything. It's all paid for. It's all paid for. He minimal amount of acres. And so who makes more money? Does he make more money keeping it old, or does the guy that can go stronger, bolder, faster, newer tech, you know, sub-inch, you know, accuracy, et cetera, do they get more? Do you have a thought on that?
That's a great angle, David. And again, for your guys, listeners looking for, you know, any profit edge, again, being the data nerd that I am, I'd sort of identified, and it's, I'm a Norwegian, so I don't like to preach to farmers. I'm pretty careful about that. But the data was pretty clear in showing me that that 5 to 8 year old range of combines and used combines and tractors, that was the place. That was the place with the margin with it. You could get a good buy. And what was at the other side of that? Again, this involves really long term thinking. But again, everyone wants the nice 10 plus year old stuff with low hours. And the 1 to 3 year old stuff, because it's so expensive now that when it has warranty, that's hot. But there was this squidgy spot in the middle, 5 to 8 years old. And now you're factoring in the new engines, the tier 4 engines and DEF. And there was this emotional reaction when I'd ask farmers, do you think when that 2012-13 model, 14, the first tier 4 engines, when they get to be 10, 12 years old, you think people want that? And a couple years ago, all farmers would say, no, no, no. But my head, because I've been doing this 31 years, I was the flip. I said, once it gets to be 10 years old, even though it's tier 4, everyone's going to want it.
Right.
That's exactly what's happening based on the cost of new. But I still think there's a little opportunity in that, you know, 4 to 7 year old range. So if you're looking for the buys, I would look there, maybe with a few more hours on it. And then again, just, you know, find one that has a great history of care. So, that's where I see the window has gotten tighter this last year, because I actually started writing about it a year ago, and then I started to see auction prices go up on 12, 13, 14 year old models, which again, I think is a reflection of how smart farmers are. They were sensing that that was a place to get a buy.
So, Greg, every podcast guest that we have on, we like to structure a question to get the guests to reflect on the common traits or characteristics of the most successful farmers that you've come across. So I'll give you some time to think about that one. While I thought of another question, based upon your answers, you both stated that, you know, the people were your favorite parts of your current role. I know that you've each met a lot of really cool people. Is there somebody in your mind, I'll start with Greg, is there somebody in your mind that you've met that, you know, you're just the coolest person ever, the most awesome relationship, or someone that just sticks out when I ask this question about who's your favorite person that you've ever met?
Wow. I met a lot of folks over the 31 years. But if you pressed me, Tanner, I'd probably say at the time he was 95 years old, Harold Brock out of Waterloo, Iowa. I was less than a year into my YouTube channel back in 2010. And a friend of mine that works for Deere said, Pete, you really need to go visit Mr. Brock. He was one of the chief engineers on the John Deere 4020. And wow. He came from Ford. He actually went to work when he was 13 years old as an apprentice for Henry Ford himself in Detroit, back when they would take smart kids to middle school and bring them in, teach engineering. So I went and interviewed him. He was 95 years old. And, you know, I don't know much about video and YouTube or whatever, but Harold was nice enough to visit, and we posted a 4-part YouTube video, and I just took my camera and asked questions. And his lifetime of knowledge, the truths were very simple. For example, at one point I asked him, Mr. Brock, what advice would you have to young people looking to get into farming? And he didn't really blink much. He just said, I would tell them to go to community college. And I said, oh, well, that's interesting. Why would you say that? And he was coming at it from that nerdy dollar angle, like, okay, figure out what you want to do, but don't take 2 years at a $40,000 university to figure out that that's not what I want to do.
Right.
And again, the things he shared about Henry Ford, and he worked with Thomas Edison and George Washington Carver, I think they're just universal truths. What I take away from people like Harold is that when you listen, whether it's to someone like that or just out at an auction, if you're open, every single day we can learn things, which is, you know, hats off to you guys for doing this podcast, because your listeners are going to get things that are going to help them be better. I think in the day and age we live, it's so easy to get focused on what we're doing. We're also busy. I don't have time to absorb this. If you do that, you're going to be less than you could be. Slow down. Put your head on a swivel. That's what my dad taught me 31 years ago. Just pay attention, and it's going to help you be better.
That's fantastic. That's my word. That's fantastic.
It's his word. He always says fantastic.
Awesome. No, that I didn't know what to expect for the answer, but that would have been an enjoyable conversation, and I'm going to have to go back and dig those YouTube videos out.
Yeah.
What about you, Dave? Who would you say has probably been your favorite person to have met?
I'm glad you asked him first, and I still don't have an answer yet. But, you know, it's the story. I had a gentleman in North Ames, Iowa that I went to, and a realtor friend called me and said, he's got a bunch of toy tractors. And I'm like, all right, toy tractors. Yeah. Okay. Can we sell this? Can we make, you know, make a dollar? How about for the, we get there and he says, hey, I want to show you, I got a couple toy tractors. We go to this guy's basement and I mean, wall to wall, top to bottom, front to back, toy tractors. And there was like 2,700 and he knew every tractor. And I think I learned more about tractors with the toy tractors. I'm like, okay, this is 40-20. No, that's a wide front, narrow front. Okay, this, no, this is this year. This is a, and I learned more models of equipment actually
through
doing
toy
the toy auction. And we sold it in two rings and we had online bidding. And the thing that I liked about this is the story. He wanted to sit with us as we cataloged everyone. So we put them all on the internet and you got to catalog each one. So, all right, here's a 4230. Oh, I got that one with my dad in Georgia when I was, and it's, so it took us a long time to catalog. I can tell you that a long time, but it was enjoyable. I think it took us 8 days. 8 days we cataloged all those tractors and we got them going. So it wasn't a huge dollar sale or, you know, anything like that, but back to the people. The story was really cool. Found out I didn't even know what the guy goes to church with me. Now we shake his hand every week at church. You know, big church. We just didn't know that he went there, different service, but that one was pretty fun.
That's fun. That's a fun story too. So Greg, a little bit more time for you to think there. What would you say is a common characteristic among the most successful farmers that you have interacted with?
Well, I two things. I would say long-term thinking, definitely. And again, it's easy to say that and to, you know, but it's hard to do it. It's really hard. It takes discipline. One of the things my dad taught me coming out of college, because I really didn't know what I wanted to do yet, but he was like, just read the business section every day. Now, whether that's your local paper or just whatever your website is, just but go into the business and just read and pay attention, because there's going to be little things that catch you. You might go 4 days and not see anything, but that fifth day, oh, well, look at that. So that's kind of going to help you make decisions, I think. And that I think the one other trait, you know, long-term thinking, but I think we need to realize that we're wrong quite often. I think it's so easy for us, you know, it's like a defense mechanism. You, whatever your deal is, it's like, well, I know what I'm doing. Yeah, but if you're not open to admitting your mistakes, it's a huge waste to not learn from your mistakes. So you got to be open to that and train yourself to be open. It's not a weakness. It's a strength when you train yourself. I mean, I've made so many mistakes along the way that now I just look at them as treasured opportunities to get better. And, again, that would be my simple/weird advice.
Well, that's another great answer. Greg, as we get ready to wrap up, if someone wants to find more out about you, I know a lot of people already know who you are and what you've got going on. What's a way for someone to find you and maybe some contact information for our listeners?
Yeah, well, again, thanks for having me on, guys. It's been really fun. The hub of what we do is our website, machinerypete.com. So I have a commentary out there every day, link to our TV show, and then anywhere across social media. I mean, if you just, whatever, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, just type Machinery Pete, you'll find me out there. And just a big thank you to your listeners for, you know, reading and interacting with our stuff all these years. It's been so much fun along the way. I've had a great time.
No, thank you for being a part of it. Dave, before I summarize, do you have any more questions for Greg?
Oh, not to get too far in the weeds. One last tip, let's say that. This is something that I've noticed on my side, and that is consignment versus retirement. if you had the opportunity to retire and sell your entire inventory, or if you thought, ah, oh, the tax man's really going to kill me and I'm just going to one-off put this on a consignment sale. One last tip for our listeners. What do you think's better?
I think 30 years of doing what I do, tracking this stuff daily, would tell me that the retirement sale collectively, you might not see it in the one or two, three pieces you were going to pick off and sell on the consignment sale. They'll probably do well anyway, but it's in maybe the Batwing mower.
Correct.
That's going to get lifted because it's David's retirement sale. One of the things we're seeing more great auction companies like Big Iron, they had, I think yesterday on their online auction, and Steffes does it and many others, but if they have a big consignment sale, playing up the fact that it's David's retirement auction within the consignment sale. There's value in the Davidness of the equipment, if you know what I mean.
That's a good point.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, well, that's another.
The only other tip I would just offer to people on the topic of long-term thinking. So maybe you're not going to be planning on trading or selling your combine planter or tractor for 1, 2, 3, 4 years. But I would strongly suggest that you get video of it in action right now, and if possible, drone video. If you know someone that has a drone, likes to screw around with them, get them out when you're harvesting and planting in particular, because drone video of that Kinze 3600 planter on a nice day in central Iowa, when you want to trade that in or sell it private 3 years from now, that I'm telling you, that's dollars in your pocket. So to not do it is just driving with our eyes closed. So get it on video, keep the video, and it's money down the road.
Well, before I summarize here, Greg, you don't even know this, but the sponsor of this episode is FlyingAg.com, a drone salesman themselves. So what a more testimonial. There is no more testimonial like advertisement for getting drone up in the air and around your equipment. You might as well go buy it from flyingag.com. But to summarize, this was an absolute blast. Again, I thank you, Greg, for being a part of this conversation. The land market, machinery market has in 2020 been solid top to bottom. Really been attributed to possibly the rising cost of new equipment on the equipment side, a lot more capital in the hands, the rising commodities. Land itself has been propped up with the increased investors, the lack of making any more of it, and again, the extra value in the balance sheet and old money sitting in the neighborhoods. The sellers have been a lot of various different ways, but in the machinery side, it's been more retirement sales, and on the land side, it's been more estate sales, so kind of an interesting dynamic between those two. Farmers are smart. I think we came across that about 5 or 6 different times in this show, that whether it was in finding a good deal to begin with and keeping the hours off of it on the land, on the equipment side, or finding that investable and appreciable land asset to help grow some value on that side. A tip to our sellers is personalize that sale experience. If you can tell your story about that piece of equipment, or your story, tile maps, etc., about the farm ground, that's going to help this value go up. If you're a buyer, pay attention to the market. Maybe jump in when everybody else is done buying, that late spring, early summer time period. Definitely avoid the end of the year for the equipment side, for tax buying on that side of things. Both Greg and David predicted that we're going to still see strong prices in land and machinery going into 2021. And the last piece of advice, like we just said, if you can get your equipment in action, or you can get an aerial view of that farm, possibly having some more eye-catching, appealing information for when you sell is going to help things go well. So, Dave, why don't you challenge our listeners today?
All right. Just like every week when we give you a challenge, I got a good one this week, and that is, Tanner, being a buyer and seller of equipment and farmland, I'm going to challenge our listeners to go out and do their research on the data that Greg provides, that I provide, to what the value of that actually is. So many times when we go to sell it, people have unrealistic expectations. And so many times when we go to buy it, we have unrealistic expectations or uneducated expectations of what that might bring. Just like when people asked Greg, how can they afford that? Realize what you're going to have to pay. On the other side, conversely, realize it might not be worth $15,000 because the neighbor sold for $15,000. Maybe yours is not the same quality. So do your homework. There's a lot of data out there, and monopolize on that data. That's my challenge.
Awesome. Thank you again, Greg. Really appreciate it. We thank you, the listener, for staying with us, sticking with us, helping us grow. Really appreciate when you like, rate, review, and share with your friends. A reminder, this is our Farm for Profit format. Next week, we will have a Farm for Fun show. So stick with us, tune in, continue to hang out. And with that, we hope you have a good one.
Remember, if you aren't farming for profit, you won't be farming for long.